Hello, I'm Jordan Farley, news editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. As you can probably tell, Jane is still on holiday, so today I'm joined by our deputy editor, Matt Matum.
Hello.
And editor-at-large, Jamie Graham.
Hello.
This week, we're putting She-Hulk, Attorney at Law, on trial, heading back to the classroom with My Old School, exploring Esther's murderous past in Orphan First Kill, and taking a bite out of delectable Welsh language horror, The Feast. But first of all, what have you guys been watching? Matt?
Well, following on from last week, I have actually been watching some of Bluey season 3, so I've started to make some headway into that, which has been very enjoyable and rewarding. And also, I saw a film, I won't talk about it too much because I'm sure we'll talk about it on a later pod. And I know you've seen it, Jordan. I don't think you have, Jamie, but Moon Age Daydream, which is this David Bowie documentary directed by Brett Morgan. And I was really blown away by it. It was absolutely fantastic. Like, extremely kind of experiential as far as those kind of documentaries go. It's sort of pretty much all told through David Bowie, really, like kind of, you know, old interview clips and, you know, archive footage and obviously a lot of performance footage. And it's sort of edited together in this kind of sort of trippy way, really has to be seen on the big screen, I would say, and really, really kind of sort of sucked me in a way that sort of, you know, few films like this have, few concert films, let's say. I mean, it's not really a concert film, but it's sort of in that ballpark. But you just truly do feel like you sort of enter a weird Bowie world for a couple of hours. And yeah, I absolutely loved it.
Yeah, it really does blur the lines between a concert movie and a straight documentary, doesn't it? Because the film opens with just pure concert footage for about 10 minutes. And I thought it was absolutely breathtaking. Mm. We both saw it in the cinema, and I would say that's absolutely the way you should try and see it if you can when it comes out, because it just sounds absolutely incredible. Mm. I've sort of never heard Bowie's music this way before.
Just literally just to go in and listen to the music is sort of plenty worthwhile just to do it on that level. But look out for more of that a bit later this year.
Can I just say, Matt Matum, that after you went to see that screening, I texted you and I said, how was your movie? And you went, yeah, it was good. Which is typical Matt statement, Matt Matum understatement. Now today you're going, oh, it's blowing away, experiential. Like, being at the gig, it's like,
He was saving his A-grade material for the podcast. Come on. He's not going to blow it on a text to you, is he?
He should do.
Jamie, what have you been up to?
Well, Fright Fest begins at the end of next week, gentlemen. The yearly sort of annual genre loving in Leicester Square, where they always show about 70 films, horror films, over 5 days. And for the first time since 2008, I can't attend, which is really, really annoying. So what I've been doing is trying to watch all the movies beforehand on screening links so that I can still cover it. And so that's what I've been doing for the last couple of weeks. I've just been watching like 2, 3, 4 horror films a day. In fact, on Saturday, I watched 6 horror films back to back. So the weird thing is that the more you, I mean, you know, I love my horror anyway, but the more you watch, the more addictive it is. But you'd actually think you'd want a break and, you know, go, oh, I fancy a comedy or whatever, but I just want to watch horror films. It's like having to watch She-Hulk this morning, much as I enjoyed it. And we'll talk about that. I was like, oh, I wish I was watching a horror movie right now. You just absolutely get in the atmosphere. But so I've watched a lot of good ones, a few very, very good ones and some terrible ones. But for anyone maybe planning to go next week, I would say The Harbinger, The Wounded Fawn and Something in the Dirt, 3 films you should maybe book for. Very good indeed.
Yeah, I saw Something in the Dirt back at Sundance earlier this year. Not my favourite. Benson and Moorhead joint, but you know, those are very creative guys. They know what they're doing. It's their sort of pandemic film, isn't it? All set in one sort of apartment, basically.
The thing is with Benson and Moorhead, who did Resolution and Spring and The Endless, is they set the bar so high with those first 3 movies that unless they absolutely knock it out the park, and it's not going to be as good. And I agree with you, it's not as good as those first 3. But I still really liked it. I love the DIY scrappiness of it and typical Benson Moorhead style. They really sort of make you scratch your scalp as you go along. And And they're both in it, like you said, real pandemic movie that they both star in it, like they did The Endless. And I thought they're both really good in it, and I love their kind of rapport in it. So, yeah, I had a lot of fun with it.
Oh, I'm good. You can't make it to Fright Fest this year, Jamie. I sort of associate you with Fright Fest more than anything.
I know. Well, I go every year and I adore it as much for the atmosphere as anything. That it's such a friendly festival. The guys who run it and all the fans and all the filmmakers who attend and the actors, everyone just hangs out. There's no hierarchy or any of that nonsense you get in other festivals. It really is, you know, you'll just be walking along and bump into Dario Argento and maybe have a little chat. And it's just super friendly, which is what the horror genre is very good for, but it's very supportive. People are all in it together. It's that fandom.
Yeah. No red carpets or stewards turning you away if you're wearing trainers, like at certain other festivals that we won't name.
Yes, well, I will name them. I can remember when you and I, Jordan, turned up for, they were showing First Blood, weren't they, in Cannes?
They were, yep. Stallone was there.
Which we were so excited. Like, we were obviously watching all the new movies, which were fantastic. But the big event we had sort of circled in our diary was First Blood in Cannes, and they were showing it on a huge screen. Sly was there and all that. And me and Jordan rocked up, like, in our shorts and trainers. And the security guards were just like, no, monsieur. That's packing. So that was the end of that one.
Yeah. In retrospect, not the smartest thing to do, but it was hot. What were we going to do? Turn up in a tux? Come on.
We were walking along the Croisette at like 3 in the afternoon in 100-degree heat and thinking, why is everyone in tuxes? This is absolutely crazy in our like khaki shorts. But we soon found out why.
Yep. Oh, fond memories. Very quickly, I'll just update on my things from last week. Matt, you'll be surprised to hear that I've now devoured all of Bluey season 3.
Whoa.
All 25 episodes. They hit the very high standard that the first two seasons do. Jamie, if you don't know, they are like 8-minute long episodes. So that was like, I don't know, half a day's viewing or something. Not that much, but they're all great. They're all great again. And I recommended this show Players last week, which is on Paramount Plus, which maybe Jamie might not be aware of it. It's basically Rocky meets Spinal Tap, but set in the world of esports. Very, very funny. Really kept me gripped to the very end. I was sort of unreasonably invested by the end, just kind of like on the edge of my seat. Digging my nails into the side of the chair, you know, all that stuff. And it sort of made esports a little bit more comprehensible to me, which is something that esports has never been before for me. So yeah, really, really top flight stuff. All right, well, moving on. If it pleases the court, it's time for this.
More and more eccentric superhumans are coming out of the woodwork. We are going to launch a division for them. And I want the She-Hulk to be the face of it.
Jennifer Waters. Namaste.
I have a serious conflict of interest. This man tried to kill my cousin, Bruce.
Yeah, that's quite all right.
Oh.
All right, so this is the latest MCU series, the first episode of which is now on Disney Plus for everyone to watch. Jamie and I have both seen the first episode. Matt, you lucky son of a gun, you've seen 4 episodes.
I've seen the first 4, yes. I was at a special screening last night in London.
Amazing. So why don't you tell us what this one is about?
So She-Hulk Attorney at Law obviously is the latest installment in the Marvel Cinematic Universe following the recent ones, Miss Marvel and Thor Love and Thunder. And this is a 9-episode series on Disney Plus. And yes, as Jordan said, the first episode's just dropped and there are 8 more to come weekly. So there's going to be 9 in total. And if you're unfamiliar with the premise, it follows Jennifer Walters, who is the cousin of Bruce Banner, aka the Hulk. Jennifer's a lawyer. And when we first meet her, she sort of is the deputy district attorney, I think. And almost immediately, she's just about to go into a case, but she breaks the fourth wall to kind of catch us up on the sort of Hulk side of her personality. So the whole first episode really is this kind of mini origin story for Jennifer, who's played by Tatiana Maslany, who's probably best known for Orphan Black. And in this sort of big flashback we see her catching up with her cousin Bruce, of course, played again by Mark Ruffalo. And at this time, he's got a special gadget to sort of keep his Hulk side under control. But very early on, there's a big car accident. Some of Bruce's blood gets mixed with Jennifer's and she takes on Hulk powers. And so then this whole sort of first episode is her sort of in this beachside retreat with Bruce, who's in the form of Smart Hulk at the moment, or Smug Hulk, depending on what side you take. You know, he's kind of filling her in with his sort of knowledge of all these years he's spent as the Hulk and kind of bringing her up to speed. And we learn very quickly that she has much more control of it than he originally had. So she can sort of slip in and out of the sort of Hulk side of her character, and she sort of retains her sort of personality and mind when she becomes her Hulk. You know, she can remember everything. She's still Jennifer when she transforms. She has it much more under control, and she basically wants to just go back to her normal life as a lawyer. She's kind of invested a lot in her career. But obviously, once you have Hulk powers, you attract a lot of attention. So that's pretty much the premise of the first episode. And then beyond that, in the next three that I watched, it sort of becomes a bit more of a sort of trial of the week almost type show, you know, where it follows that sort of legal format. And yeah, we sort of see new cases as the sort of episodes unfold.
Did you like it?
I enjoyed it a lot, actually, for the first episodes. This was the first time, because I said I saw this at a special screening. So I actually saw these on the big screen, and I saw it was all four back to back. No kind of credits until the end. Yeah, it sort of went along really quickly for me. I kind of was wondering how it would play if I only got one per week. And obviously the first episode is quite different to the others, in the sense that, you know, there's a lot of Bruce obviously in the first episode, and there's a lot of kind of, you know, establishing her powers. And then it moves into that, like I say, that legal comedy sort of format afterwards. The thing I particularly liked, and I think this is just something that Marvel has got right time and time again, is Tatiana Maslany. I thought she was just very, very charming and funny as the character. And I thought it was interesting sort of seeing a sort of female spin on it. I liked the fourth wall breaking stuff. I actually could have done with a little bit more of that, actually. I almost feel like they don't do it quite enough, but maybe we'll get more as it goes along. I thought it was very funny as well. I just thought there were some very funny lines in it.
Yeah, the fourth wall breaking stuff, she's very sparingly, isn't it? I mean, She-Hulk was the first character to do it in the comics, I believe, or at least did it before Deadpool, who, of course, is the character who's sort of best known for breaking the fourth wall nowadays. I don't know if they're concerned about stepping on Deadpool's toes a little bit, or if they feel like that joke's been done a little bit too much in Fleabag and they didn't want to be accused of just ripping that off. It's a little bit unclear entirely why at the moment they've even included the fourth wall breaking stuff, other than just to be faithful to Jennifer Walters' comic book origins. But as I say, only seen the first episode, it could be used in more interesting ways as it goes on. Jamie, you've only seen the first episode as well. What were your thoughts after episode one?
I really liked episode one. I thought it was really lively and fun. The tone was lovely. I agree that Tatiana Maslany was absolutely wonderful in the lead, which I agree Marvel keep getting that right in Ms. Marvel as well. You know, I thought that was absolutely great, the casting. I really enjoyed it. It's where it goes from here, really, because if it is going to do that sort of case of a week thing, it's very important they sort of nail it and get that just right. You know, quite aside from the Hulk aspects and the action aspects and all of that, I really hope they get it, like, you know, in the first four or five episodes of WandaVision, when they were doing the whole sitcom thing, they absolutely nailed it. You know, it was perfect. And then maybe the second half of WandaVision wasn't as strong as the second half of the series, but those first episodes were great. I do like it when they sort of poke their fingers into different genre pies and sort of go, right, we're going to do our spin on this. So, yeah, I really enjoyed it. I'm excited to see the rest of them. I like the fact that it very much played into the sort of, this is the female Hulk perspective, and, you know, that whole thing that women have 5,000 reasons more to get angry than men. You know, there's a line in it where she sort of says that fear and anger or resentment or something like that is pretty much the baseline of the female experience. Because every day they have to, you know, deal with toxic men, which we see in the first episodes, and guys just cracking onto her outside a bar, and then, you know, people at work mansplaining stuff to her and putting her down. So it's that whole thing of, you know, being a female Hulk, every single day there must be 500 times a day you want to explode into rage, and it's whether she can sort of control that. So I like the fact that they're really digging into that, and I hope they continue to do that.
That sort of thematic side of it very much continues over the four episodes that I saw. I'm not as big of a fan of the sort of legal courtroom drama as you, Jamie, but for me, it was sort of that side of it was fun, but I don't think you'd watch it purely if you just were a fan of legal dramas, comedies, yeah, and you wanted that sort of, you know, courtroom action. It very much, to me, it did feel like a sort of a Marvel property with a sprinkling of that sort of side of things in it, as opposed to, you know, that with a sprinkle of Marvel, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Again, like I say, I'm not as sort of in tune with the genre as you, so maybe you'll feel a bit differently, but that's how it seemed to me.
Yeah. What about you, Jordan? Are you a fan?
Yeah, I would pretty much echo what both of you guys have been saying. I thought the first episode was terrific fun. I just loved the chemistry between Ruffalo's Hulk and Tatiana Maslany's She-Hulk. They have this very enjoyable cousin chemistry going on, bit of joshing around. Mm. You know, they don't pull their punches with each other. The other thing I was really impressed by actually was the CGI, because obviously there was a lot of criticism in the run-up to the release of this show from the trailers, the brief glimpses we had of the VFX in that they perhaps weren't up to the standards that we would hope of a project like this. But I thought the VFX in this first episode were astonishing for TV, at least movie quality, and arguably better than some of the CG we've been seeing in Marvel movies of late. I thought there was perhaps a tiny bit of uncanny valley going on with She-Hulk, particularly around her hair. It was kind of bobbing around a little bit, but Ruffalo's Hulk, they've completely nailed it. I think he looks better than he's ever looked in this episode.
Yeah. The faces are great, I think, especially on Ruffalo's Hulk. And throughout the rest of the series, I could just accept it. I didn't think it was the very sort of top flight CGI that we've seen, but you know, I could just accept it as part of, especially with it as it's something with a sort of lighter tone generally. The main slight issue I had with it is I thought the faces were pretty good, but in some of the later episodes where we sort of see her in the She-Hulk form walking around in a suit, some of that was very sort of stick man-y, like kind of, you know, felt like rigid arms and limbs kind of moving, and that felt a bit uncanny at times. But on the whole, it wasn't enough to sort of detract from my enjoyment, really.
I was wondering if they'd blown like their entire VFX budget on the first episode, and that's how it looks so good. But it sounds like they haven't done that entirely, so that's good news.
So Matt, in episodes 2, 3, and 4, do we get more Bruce Banner, or does he disappear altogether?
You don't get loads more in 2, 3, and 4. As always, we're asked sort of ahead of this screening not to reveal any sort of big spoilers or anything like that, which obviously I won't. But one of the things I'd say is there's almost not a huge amount I could spoil having seen the first 4 episodes. Like sometimes, like with things like Moon Knight, for example, I remember you're given a certain number of episodes and they end at a point where it's like, whoa, you know, you can see why they stopped here and didn't give you any more because it ends on a massive cliffhanger or something like that. But that wasn't really the case with this one, I didn't think. In terms of things people will know about, obviously Tim Roth is in this as Emil Blonsky, the Abomination. I thought he was very, very fun. I really, really enjoyed him sort of returning to this. Obviously, we got a brief bit of Abomination in Shang-Chi, but it was nice to have sort of Tim Roth back properly here. This is sort of a spoiler to say something that doesn't happen. I don't know if that's a spoiler, but we don't really see much more of Jameela Jamil's character, Titania. There's a sort of a hint at where it's going later in the episodes, but especially as she's been such a big part of the promo, I kind of presumed her sort of villain character would have been more established early on, but still not really, you know, not really had much of her at all by the time you finish the first 4 episodes.
Still 5 episodes to go, though.
Yeah, so still more than half left, so.
Yeah. One of the other things that I really enjoyed in this first episode is the fact that, you know, we've had a couple of shows and maybe even a couple of Marvel films now that have felt fairly standalone and fairly disconnected from the MCU at large, specifically Moon Knight, and to a lesser extent, even Thor, Love and Thunder, Ms. Marvel. And I love that this is really leaning into the connections and having fun with them. There's a very funny discussion about whether Steve Rogers is a virgin, which has a tremendous payoff if you stick around till after the credits. I understand there's going to be post-credit scenes after every episode, so definitely stick around for the end of the credits with this show. And as you mentioned, you know, you have Abomination showing up in future episodes. Trailers have already teased the fact that Wong shows up in this show. Daredevil's going to show up in this show at some point, and I'm pretty confident that they aren't going to be the only cameos. So I'm just glad that they're finally taking advantage of the fact that they have this huge world of connected characters to do something fun, as opposed to, you know, making them fight another world-ending threat in an Avengers movie. They're just flying in people for cameos, and that's all good by me. I think they could have a lot of fun with that.
There is a lot of fun with Abomination. It does address his sort of Shang-Chi appearance as well, which was nice, because I was kind of wondering how that was going to all slot together, but they do address that.
That's great. Thumbs up on She-Hulk all around, it sounds like.
Yeah.
All right, well, that's She-Hulk, the first episode of which is on Disney Plus right now, and future episodes are airing every Thursday. All right, next up, it's time to go back to school with this.
Brandon Lee acts as if he's been a pupil at Bearstown Academy from the very beginning.
Hiding in plain sight. It's about the best place you can hide.
Police found that Lee had two passports.
People thought he might be a spy.
And that was when he said,
"My name isn't Brandon Lee, and I'm not who you think I am."
What? They're human beings, but to me they were just a means to an end. There was no crime committed, technically.
Was it morally acceptable?
It's a story which is seemingly never ending.
He was playing absolutely everybody around him.
Why? Why did he do it?
What would possess someone to do that?
Matt, what's this one about?
So this is my old school, obviously, and it's one of these sort of stranger than fiction documentaries that really it's kind of best to go in fairly cold if you can, because the whole fun is sort of seeing this story unfurl. And It is really quite an unbelievable story. So it's just, I would say, enjoy it as kind of fresh as you can. So I'll keep this introduction brief and sort of spoiler free with just what you'll get really from the very opening minutes of the documentary. The story we're following takes place in 1993 at a sort of school in a nice area of Glasgow. The school is called Bearstown Academy. Basically, we learn very early on, it's all about this sort of pupil at the school called Brandon Lee. And it is addressed, obviously, the fact that he shares a name with the late Crow star. Basically, you get the sense from the off that something wasn't quite right, that something strange happens. There's something not quite right about this guy. And a really sort of interesting device about it is the whole thing is really sort of a combination of talking heads and animation go, you know, kind of to sort of bring the school days back to life, I suppose. And the talking head for Brandon Lee is done in an unusual way, because what you have is he didn't want to appear on camera in this film. So while his sort of audio is recorded, Alan Cumming, the actor, the Scottish actor, he sort of lip syncs basically his audio and kind of performs it as the talking head. And there's kind of an extra sort of meta dimension there as well, because sort of years ago, Alan Cumming was sort of in line to play him in a sort of, you know, dramatized film version of this story. And it just adds a really sort of fascinating dimension, because when I first heard about this, I thought it was going to be almost kind of jokey or silly, but he actually does it really well, and he actually matches up to the words incredibly well. I don't know, I mean, it wasn't clear to me from just watching the documentary if he had a video reference as well as the audio, but he kind of really, really gets it sort of just right. And I was expecting it to be more of a sort of comic juxtaposition, you know, that this clearly wasn't the person speaking, but he does a really good job about it. So that's a kind of fascinating sort of element to it. And then you also get lots of different people who were in the same class as Brandon sort of piecing it all together in kind of these talking heads interviews. That is kind of interesting as well, because it's sort of interesting on the dimension of just that classic, like thinking back to your school days and sort of reminiscing, and this kind of sort of chemistry, I guess, that exists with these people. But then obviously there is this just very sort of fascinating, weird story of this guy, Brandon Lee. And he's kind of come to school with this sort of strange sort of backstory. You know, you learn more as it unfolds, and there's obviously some sort of big reveals and things get very weird. And it's just, yeah, it's one of those documentaries that will sort of is jaw dropping at times in terms of what transpires.
Jamie, what did you think?
Again, I really liked it. Thought it was really good. I agree. Alan Cumming gives a really kind of top-notch performance doing the lip syncing, and just it's not sort of uncanny valley. You kind of almost forget that he's just miming the words, you know, he's doing all the expressions, he's totally emotionally invested in it. You just sort of watch him and go along with it. And the story is fascinating, and what I found interesting about it is, I'm trying to sort of not say anything, give anything away here, but you kind of get the gist of what it's going to be, what the reveal is going to be very early. And it's not like they're trying to hide it. You know, in the first 2 minutes almost, you kind of know where it's going to go, what the twist is going to be. But what is surprising is just the extent of it. I'm sort of wording it very carefully, but even though you sort of get the outline of, oh, it's going to be this is what's going on, when you actually go into it and how sort of deeply it dives into it and just how far this kind of rippled outwards. Again, if you don't know what I'm talking about, I'm probably it sounds like I'm talking here, but it really, what I'm trying to say is, even though you kind of know it, it still surprises you because it keeps going further and further and further. And you're going like, oh my God, how did he do that and get away with that? And like, so yeah, it's mad. And also what I liked about it, apart from it having that sort of crazy twist quality, it's also a really sad and poignant story and a bit creepy in places. There's all these emotions, and it's kind of that whole thing about sort of almost like, what are you doing with your life, or can you waste your life, or want to sort of you know, almost wish you'd gone in different directions. And there's a real sort of undercurrent of sadness to it. I found it quite moving, but yeah, it's really good, really interesting documentary.
Brandon, the main character, he's not a malicious character, or at least I didn't get the impression he's a malicious character. I don't think he did what he did for bad reasons. He did it for quite legitimate and understandable reasons, which just makes it all, there is definitely that layer of tragedy to it. But then on the other hand, I did actually find this just a really sort of fun and frothy documentary, because you have these sort of larger than life characters as interviewees. Jono MacLeod, the director, he actually went to school with Brandon, the main character, and he is essentially interviewing his fellow classmates who have obviously now grown up, and they're all just really quite engaging, really funny people. They're constantly like ribbing each other, talking about old memories, and all that's kind of really infectious and joyous, which is a really interesting contrast to this quite tragic story that's being told. Tragic on one level, but also kind of outrageous and unbelievable on another. Had either of you two heard of this before watching this film? Because this was like, sort of national headline news.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, people, especially people of a certain age, I guess, because I was still, like, I was nine, I guess, in 1993. So it just kind of passed me by. But people a bit older may well just remember the story from the news. Yeah, because it was clearly a huge thing. I had no memory of it.
I was 20 in 1993, and I've got no memory of it, but that's because I was at university in 1993, and I spent the whole 3 years just partying and watching movies and getting drunk. So I had no sort of real world touchstones whatsoever for 3 years. I certainly watched the news. I kind of watched Neighbours and Home and Away and lots of movies and got drunk a lot. But so I didn't know it. I had read a couple of reviews before I saw the film about a month or so ago, so I kind of knew the outline from that, but it still really, really hooked me. And we should also say as well that even though Brandon Lee doesn't appear in it, that he doesn't want his face on camera, and because it's animation, you don't see him through the whole film. Right at the end, we do get to see him because he was in the school production of South Pacific. He played the lead role in the fifth year at school. And they actually have archive footage of that performance. So it's a wonderful moment right at the end of the film where we actually get to see him. And it's like, wow, there he is.
The one thing I would say is that I was sort of less sold on is the animation itself, because you don't have this wealth of archive material like they have for, you know, documentaries along these lines, like Three Identical Strangers or The Imposter, like, you know, docs like that. So they get creative with these animated recreations, which is sort of a sound idea in principle, particularly because it is all set. It is all school kids that they're portraying. And I've seen the animation described online as Daria-esque, which I can sort of see, but I'm sort of very skeptical that was a touchstone, because I don't know, was Daria even a thing in the UK the way it was in the States? I certainly never watched it.
When I was watching the animation, it put me in mind of Beavis and Butthead more than anything else.
Yeah.
Very simple 2D animation, but it was more sort of colourful than Beavis and Butthead, but I quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, the thing it put me in mind of was like early sort of flash animation that you would get online. Like, to me, it just looked a tiny bit cheap. Like, they just didn't have the budget to do anything more complex. So what you end up with is something that, for me, wasn't particularly visually interesting or dynamic, interrupting a generally very well-told story. So that was sort of the one slight niggle for me.
I didn't feel that, because I thought it kind of fitted the time and the themes of the film. That very early on in the film, it may even be the credits, there's a direct sort of visual reference to Grange Hill. That bit in the Grange Hill credits where suddenly the sausage is shoved onto someone's plate. And for me, it was kind of doing that, but the sort of 80s, early 90s, you know, it had that sort of naffness to it. You know, and I say that someone who went to school at that time, so it was almost sort of slightly naff animation. I kind of felt quite affectionate towards it.
I actually didn't mind it as well. Jordan actually mentioned this to me before I saw the film, so maybe that sort of prepared me a bit. Could have obviously been done differently. Maybe it would have been nicer to have a sort of sketchier sort of scrapbook style or something like that. But it sort of worked for me with the sort of strangeness of the story as well. So it certainly didn't really bother me that much.
Well, if you want to find out the secret of my old school, it hits cinemas tomorrow. All right, next up. Alternative line reading, which, if you don't know, I'm going to take a moderately well-known film quote, say it in the style of someone very unexpected, and Jamie and Matt have got to try and guess where it's from and I guess who said it. All right, this time, apropos of nothing, I'm going to do it in the style of Joe Pesci. Well, my attempt at Joe Pesci, which is not going to sound anything like the actual Joe Pesci, and it's short and sweet, so listen up, because I won't be repeating this.
Okay.
Are you going to smash up the room as you do it?
Yeah, I'm method. I've already got into character, so cool. I'll be taking a short break after I've said this line.
Better luck next time, slugheads!
Oh my god. That sounded more like a sort of a Warner Brothers cartoon.
It sounded more like Mark Hamill's Joker to me.
Oh, yeah. Maybe I should have said I was doing the Joker. Mm. Yeah, good point. Mate. I mean, I'm sorry, Joe Pesci. I'm so sorry.
I've got no idea anyway, by the way.
If I was in Casino and had my head in a vice, and then Joe Pesci started talking to me like that, I'd just start giggling. There's no threat whatsoever.
And then your eyes would pop out a second later, because I'm so angry.
On a serious note, can you just repeat it? Because I was so distracted. I missed it. All I heard was slug.
I'm sorry. That's the beauty of the game, mate.
Oh no.
We were saying about slug heads, but well, I'm just going to guess purely in the sort of that it often ties to a film that's out. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to guess: is it X2 featuring Alan Cumming?
Incorrect. However, I will give you a clue and say you're on the right track with the actor.
It's not GoldenEye, is it?
Yeah, ding ding ding. Yes.
I saw the end of that on TV recently. That was the only other thing that sprung to mind when I was thinking of Alan Cumming.
Yep, it's Boris Grushenko in GoldenEye, and that sounds a little bit like this.
Better luck next time, slugheads.
I would have got it if the quote was, "I am invincible."
Exactly. Well, that's too well known, you see. Yeah. I had to go for something slightly more obscure, but, you know, true Bond fans will have known exactly what that was from. All right, after that nonsense, next up, it's time for more Child's Play with this.
I think something's going on with Esther.
Is there anything you want to tell me about your time away?
How's that possible? 4 years ago, she was still drawing stick figures.
Esther's behavior has been so erratic.
Hello, Mommy. Thank you, Mommy.
I did notice some inconsistencies.
What are you getting at?
To me, it felt like a performance.
If you're not Esther, who are you?
All right, that's all from First Kill. the extremely belated sequel to 2009's Orphan, which starred Isabel Furman as a 9-year-old orphan girl called Esther, who was adopted by a new family and is, I would say, best remembered for its completely outrageous and unhinged twist that, spoiler alert, Esther isn't in fact a young girl, but a 33-year-old woman with a growth defect that means she's perpetually trapped inside the body of a girl. And this appears to have made her slightly homicidal. The problem that the makers of this sequel, or should I say prequel, had was that Esther dies quite violently at the end of Orphan. So they've gone the prequel route, which actually also taps into a throwaway line from the first film about Esther's first adopted family, which I won't spoil because it is actually a spoiler for this film if you've seen the first film. So this sequel, Orphan First Kill, it opens in Estonia at the Saarne Institution, where Esther, as she comes to be known, is a patient. Already, she's considered extremely dangerous, but the security there is seemingly so lax that she escapes very easily, makes her way to America, and inveigles her way into a wealthy American family whose daughter went missing in recent years by pretending that she is that daughter who was kidnapped and has now returned. The mother, played by Julia Stiles, is overjoyed, as is the father, played by Rossi Sutherland. But Esther's new brother, Gunnar, is immediately skeptical that something is up, something's fishy. And he's not wrong, because Esther is a psychopath who is prepared to go to murderous lengths to secure her place in the family, until the film drops another outrageous twist, which completely flips it on its head. You've sort of got to admire the mind that waits 13 years to make a sequel to a film that's only remembered because of one twist. I would like to get behind that kind of mad decision-making, but there's another even more insane decision going on in this film, which is the fact that 25-year-old Isabel Furman, who was, you know, a young girl at the time she made the first Orphan 13 years ago, is still playing a 9-year-old in this film, which is insane on just a number of levels. And the way that they achieve this is through very cheap tricks. There's a lot of forced perspective. There's a lot of people standing on boxes. There's a lot of very obvious, like, body doubles. So there's never one moment where you are convinced that Isabel Furman is actually playing a 9-year-old girl in this film. It's absolutely outrageous that they thought they could pull this off. They never do at any point. So on one level, it actually becomes like unintentionally hilarious, because you're just spotting like, oh, that's where they've inserted like an actual 9-year-old girl. I wonder how big the box Julia Stiles is stood on there. At one point they're going down an escalator and I thought, oh my God, like, what have they done? Have they put her on like a giant apple crate while she's on the escalator, or is Isabel Furman kneeling down? Like, all this obviously takes you completely out of the film and you can't buy into any of it. And even though we won't go into it here, there is another completely bonkers twist in the middle of this, which makes absolutely no sense. Just complete drivel. Like, I sort of admire the fact that they tried to outdo the first film with the twist, but they just haven't really at all. It's just complete nonsense. And even taking all that aside, I don't think it's a particularly great horror film in its own right. It's not scary. A lot of it's quite cheap. It relies on a lot of the same tricks that the first film did. Like, there's all this stuff with black light, which is just cribbed from the first film almost completely. At least with the first film, it felt like Juan Colet-Serra, who was the director, who of course is directing this summer's Black Adam and has gone on to do some good stuff. It felt like he had a bit of something to him as a director, but this just felt really flat to me. What did you think, Jamie?
I agree with all of that. I thought it was really pretty terrible, to be honest. The first movie is a really average horror movie that, like you said, Juan Colet-Serra directs it. So he does an okay job, and it's got Peter Sarsgaard and Vera Farmiga.
Good cast.
Which adds a bit of class. It is. It adds a bit of class, but it's a sort of mediocre horror movie that's going along quite nicely. And then it has this bonkers twist at the end, which kind of elevates it. But that's what you remember. And you think, oh, that was really good fun. But it wasn't really. It was really good fun because the twist is so mad and it sticks with you. Whereas this, on the other hand, is just bad all the way through, mainly for the reason you said, that Isabel Furman, she was 12 years old when she played the role the first time. She's now 25. And you just can't buy it at all. You just cannot. But it just makes a nonsense of the entire movie. So you can't get into it. I did like the fact that the big twist in this one happens two-thirds of the way through rather than right at the end. I thought that was a bit different and surprising. After that twist, it's quite interesting in some ways that it sort of goes in a direction I didn't expect. And there's, you know, a certain amount of enjoyment that comes out of it in a kind of whatever happened to Baby Jane kind of, you know, heightened madhouse kind of way, you know, that it's almost like camp classic territory because it's so crazy. But it's just bad.
It's really a film that's sort of crippled by this decision to have Isabel Furman, who is generally a great actress, like she's terrific in that film, The Novice, come back to play this character. Because I remember the joy of the original Orphan, which I haven't seen since 2009, so it's been a while. The sort of joy of it for me was you had that sort of omen quality of the fact that there was this actual 12-year-old girl who is the horror movie boogeyman. And it's just kind of fun to see a kid running around like bludgeoning people and murdering adults, you know. And you don't even get that sort of visceral thrill from this film because it's just obviously a grown woman who's playing this character. And I just found it really funny that they would just always shoot her at the bottom of the frame as well. Like, yeah, she would always have about 10 feet of screen above her head, like no matter what situation she was in. Like, it was just trying so hard to convince you that she was this 9-year-old girl. And I just couldn't get over it for one second. The one element I did enjoy actually is Julia Stiles, who I think has sort of committed to just how daft this film is and is just going with it. So the big twist does sort of hinge on her character in a way. So if you're wondering why an actress of Julia Stiles' caliber would be involved in a film like this, she does get some quite meaty fun stuff to do later in the film. So I enjoyed it on that one level. But this film does also have probably one of the worst performances I've seen in recent years, which is the Gunner character, the brother character. Just, I don't know if that's down to the performance or the direction, but it just didn't work on any level. Just, he's just such an idiot. Like, I just hated him in every way and just didn't understand why he was saying the things he was saying or doing the things he was doing. Just didn't feel remotely believable to me in any way. Yeah, it's very odd that they brought this back, I think, 13 years since Orphan. Was anyone crying out for an Orphan sequel? Does it feel like there's any sort of fan base for this that would are excited about this?
I hate to say it, but you've actually made me quite desperate to see it. Sort of comedy value.
Yeah, I imagine it's a film that would play quite well at like the Prince Charles Cinema, where people can just kind of have that communal comedy experience with it and just laugh at everything that's going on.
If you treat it in a sort of camp classic way, there's a certain amount of fun to be had from it. You know, because of that original twist in the first movie, which really is, it's up there with Sleepaway Camp and with Malignant that we had last year as one of the all-time most bonkers horror movie twists at the end of a film you'll ever see. Because of that, I think there's a certain amount of goodwill to it that genre fans maybe would be slightly excited all these years later, like, oh, I enjoyed Orphan, like Orphan First Kill, yeah, I'll give that a go, but it's just bad. And what I don't understand is it's actually getting some okay reviews somewhere. You know, like Jordan and I have just absolutely slated it. We probably should say other people seem to be having more fun with it. Maybe they're just going with it and enjoying it through its crapness, I don't know, but it's got some quite affectionate reviews. But I just thought it was bad, start to finish bad.
It's definitely bad. I don't disagree with that. My one question is, I wonder if the director and the filmmakers are in on the joke at all. Like, do they know that they're making something very silly and they're leaning into it? Like, just the fact that they've cast Isabel Furman just makes me think they must be on some level. Like, surely they didn't think they could pull this off. I just don't know. I'm sort of boggled by it all.
But then, like you said, they try so hard to disguise the fact that she's 25 years old now. But, you know, I think they maybe use a bit of VFX, the aging as well, but they certainly use stunt doubles and forced perspectives and all of that. And so that almost sort of undercuts that argument that they knew it was mad and they went with it because they're really trying to make her look like a sort of 9-year-old girl and it just doesn't work.
Yeah. Well, if you want to find out what the latest completely insane twist in the Orphan franchise is, head to your local cinema. Okay, finally, it's time to feast on this.
At about the Newell Magnuses.
Gnava!
But that's The Feast. Jamie, do you want to set this one up for us?
So it is a debut feature movie from Lee Haven Jones, and it's a Welsh folk horror movie. And it's about a kind of well-to-do family. Glenda and Glyn are the father and mother. Two teenage sons who are both a bit odd, which I'll talk about in a minute. But they live in this sort of modernist house in the middle of nowhere. And they're having a dinner party. They're inviting a neighbour round later in the evening, and they're inviting round a guy who has kind of looked after their money for many years. He's kind of pointed them in the right way of certain investments and made them a lot of money. So they're getting these two people around with the idea that they want their money guy to talk to the neighbour and maybe help her out and point her in a way to make some quick money as well. Now, on the morning of the feast, their usual helper, the woman from the local pub who comes along and always helps prepare the feast and lays the tables and all of that, she can't make it. So she sends along another helper called Caddy, played by Anne Elwy, who is going to sort of just prepare everything, get it ready. And right from the off, there's something clearly not quite right there. She lurks around this house and keeps spying family members doing things that maybe they shouldn't. And there's a slight sort of creepiness to it. And throughout the day, they're preparing for this dinner party, and then the dinner party happens and it all goes from there. I don't want to give anything more away, but it's quite sort of creepy and out there and quite nasty in the latter stages.
This is the year of horrible dinner party films. We've got The Feast, Flux Gourmet coming up, Peter Strickland's new film, and The Menu, starring Ralph Fiennes and Anya Taylor-Joy, also coming up later this year. Do you think this one's going to be remembered when it comes to the best disgusting dinner movies come the end of the year, Jamie?
I think it will, but how big an audience it will find, I don't know, because it's quite a small movie. I think, you know, horror fans will certainly seek it out. What I liked about it is it's really controlled and minimalist and very sort of steadily paced. And it sort of takes its cue from the modernist house in a way, but it's very sort of clean and elegant. And you follow these characters and it slowly builds. So in the final third, when it does kind of get a bit nasty, and there's two or three real gross out moments that were sort of, you know, it pulls the sit trigger a little bit. And, you know, there's a bit of body horror in there. But when they come, they're all the more effective because it's been so sort of quiet in its journey to that point. I think it's really good. I think that the subtext, you know, it's one of those, like many horror movies at the moment of the last few years, it's about something and it really wants you to know that. And I think its messaging is a little bit on the nose, that it could have been sort of buried a bit more. The subtext is almost text in this film. But apart from that, I think it's really quite impressive. It's really unnerving. It's really well made. The acting's terrific. Anne Zellry playing Caddy, the lead. If you don't know the actress, she played Beth in Little Women a couple of years ago. I think she's absolutely terrific. There's a lot going on there, but she's really creepy and strange. But at the same time, she's sort of, you like her and she's quite seductive in a way. Yeah, I think it's really good. I hope it finds an audience. I really do. You know, there's so many films out there. And like I said, this is a small film. It may get lost in the mix. But I think if you give it a go, you will enjoy it very much.
Matt, did this one push your buttons?
Yeah, I felt largely similar to Jamie. Perhaps I didn't like it quite as much as him, but it has a very impressive sort of atmospheric kind of tone and this sort of weirdness to it. And I thought it was like that sort of classic case of like directorial debut where you really think this is someone to watch. Like it sort of clearly has a sort of strong directorial voice. And kind of like what Jamie said, I was almost a bit taken back by it. It does have some sort of, you know, you've got to have quite a strong stomach for it in the sort of last stretch of the film. Whereas because it is so sort of quiet and controlled early on, I sort of almost wasn't expecting it to go that way. So ultimately, it didn't entirely sort of come together for me, but there was lots I sort of enjoyed about it, and I thought it was, yeah, like atmospheric and definitely one of those impressive calling cards, I would say, for future work.
I haven't seen this yet, but I'm very excited to. Is the fact that it's been made in Welsh, does that add anything to it in terms of a welcome exercise in diversity and representation for a language which typically isn't used on screen?
It is good for diversity. It gives it a sort of point of difference to many movies out there, which is always interesting. You know, we see so much stuff that feels samey. Where this house is set, you know, it's a great place to shoot a movie, all these open fields and nature, and then right in the middle of it, this strange brick structure is a little nugget of info for you, a sort of a factoid. But it's the same house that was used in You Should Have Left, the horror movie that came out a couple of years ago starring Kevin Bacon. And it's actually called Lifehouse, and it's quite a famous building, apparently. I didn't know this, by a famous architect. I can't remember their name. But yeah, it's the same house. So if you've seen that movie, you may recognise it. But yeah, it's really good, and it's good to see the movie in Welsh. I did enjoy it, and it makes you sort of, reading the subtitles also makes you lean in, you know, which I think really aids this movie, because it is a quiet film and you sort of want to get into that tone and sort of inside that house, and there's strange things going on, you know, all the characters sort of keep spying each other doing stuff through the glass walls and stuff, and it almost adds to that you're kind of there with sort of lent right in listening to the whispers. So but yeah, it worked.
From what you guys have been saying, it sounds like one not to watch over dinner, maybe leave your food till later.
Definitely. There are some sick-making moments in it. And not in a big sort of Sam Raimi splash the gore around kind of way. It's, again, the moments are quite controlled, but they're really quite nasty and make you squirm.
So maybe leave the snacks when you go to see The Feast. That's it for reviews. Another packed week, and we haven't even seen Fisherman Friends sequel One and All, which I know you'll be racing to the cinema to see this weekend, Jamie.
I've seen the trailer, and it was pretty much the whole film.
Was it? I've deliberately avoided the trailer because I don't want to ruin it for myself. I cannot wait for this movie. Can't wait.
Well, it's good to know. You'll have to tell us your thoughts next week. but tell me, lads, what is your film of the week or TV show?
It's close with She-Hulk, but I'm going to go for My Old School because I really, really did enjoy it.
Well, I think it's been a strong week, and I give big shout-outs for My Old School and She-Hulk. Really enjoyed them both, but I'm going to go The Feast. I thought it was great.
I'm going to go She-Hulk. I think very, very entertaining. I don't think anyone who watches it and is into the MCU will be disappointed.
We've all gone for different things, so everyone listening, you have to go and watch them all.
Exactly. Just don't go and watch Orphan First Kill unless you're really into very silly horror
films.
But
I mean, that's what I'm going away to watch after this. So.
Well, I'm sure you'll have a great weekend, Matt. All right, Jane will be back next week, but we can't leave without mentioning the fact that it's new Total Film Week. Hooray! And this month, the big man himself, Dwayne Johnson, graces the cover as Black Adam, the new DC anti-hero, alongside the Justice Society of America. Matt, you spoke to DJ. How was it?
Yes, I spoke to DJ in person for this. Always a pleasure. Wow. And he always can, you know, has that ability to just get you extremely hyped for a film, which he obviously did here. So that was kind of great fun. And spoke to the rest of the Justice Society and the director and producers all about Black Adam. So yes, that's kind of all in the new issue, which is on shelves now, and subscribers obviously should have their copies as well.
Yeah, it's a terrific deep dive into Black Adam. I was incredibly excited about the film after I read your feature, Matt.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, no problem, mate. We've also got some other very exciting stuff. There's a big deep dive into Andor, which our very own Matthew Leyland wrote, speaking to Tony Gilroy, Diego Luna, a lot of very exciting people involved in that show. Jamie, you spoke to the great Michael Mann.
Talking of the big man, I mean, Dwayne Johnson is a big man in many ways, but for me, Michael Mann is the big man. Terrific director, one of the great American filmmakers of the last 40 years. I have wanted to interview him my whole career and never got close to him. He's one of the ones who I keep missing. So it was an absolute pleasure to finally catch up with him to talk Heat 2, which is a novel that he has penned, which is a sequel to his 1995 crime masterpiece, Heat, obviously, with Robert De Niro and Al Pacino. And this novel takes place both, it goes forwards and backwards. A lot of it is set in 1988 in Chicago, when Neil McCauley and Hannah Vincent are younger men and very different men, and they're kind of circling each other then without knowing it. And then it jumps forward to 2000, 4 years after Heat, 5 years after Heat. And we follow the Val Kilmer character as he kind of goes off to Paraguay and Mexico and gets involved in different crime ventures. It's a really, really good novel. It's very James Ellroy-like. It's sort of tough and terse, very clipped dialogue, prose, very authentic, really well plotted, sprawling, epic, really good. So I talked to him all about Heat 2 and then all of his career, all the big hits, Last of the Mohicans, Manhunter, Collateral, you know, all the biggies, The Insider. So that was an absolute joy.
What I want to know is, what does Michael Mann make of Black Adam? Judging by what he says in your interview, I don't think he's going to be into it, unfortunately.
He's not over keen on modern action films.
He's not.
He put them down quite strongly.
I obviously mentioned Moon Age Daydream earlier, and I knew you'd see that, Jordan, because you've got a deep dive into that with the director.
I do, yeah. I spoke to Brett Morgan, that film's director, at Cannes, actually, earlier this year, where that film premiered out of competition. He's a very interesting man. He's made a couple of music documentaries before, most notably Cobain, Montage of Heck, and Crossfire Hurricane, the Rolling Stones documentary, both terrific films. Moon Age Daydream is a real passion project for him. He's been working on it for the last 5 years. I go into this a bit more depth in the feature, but he actually had a heart attack at the start of this process, nearly died. He was in a coma for a week. He very much credits David Bowie and his philosophies on life with turning his life around and essentially saving his life. So, there's a lot of interesting stories behind this film, beyond the fact that it's, you know, I would argue the first great Bowie film since the great man's passing in 2016.
I've read your feature, Jordan, which was terrific, not just saying that. What amazed me was the fact that Bowie's estate kind of opened the archives, didn't they? They gave him the key.
Yeah.
And everything he's filmed, and he sort of chronicled his whole life and everything he had on record. They said, there you go, you know, make of it what you will. And I think you said in your feature, over 5 million sort of clips and archive material pieces to wade through, which is why the film took 5 years to make, to sort of sort through all that and put it into order and find a narrative. And yeah, it's amazing. I can't wait to see it. I haven't seen a screening yet, but the moment it comes out of cinema, I would be at the biggest screen I can find for that one.
Yeah, 5 million pieces of archive material. And then they went out on their own and found more archive material to add to that 5 million pieces. They sort of said they projected sort of 3 months to go through all this material to, you know, index it and collate it into like a kind of chronological order. And it ended up taking them 2 years, which is pretty insane.
Not one person wading through it thinking it would take 3 months. That's a whole team of researchers going at it for 2 years.
Exactly. So that's our Black Adam issue, which is on sale right now. You can go to your local newsagents and pick it up, give it a read. All right, finally, it's time for another listener question, which is, in honor of She-Hulk, what's your favorite courtroom scene? Jamie, you want to go on this one?
I'm going to go really obvious on this one, and I'm going to go A Few Good Men, You Can't Handle the Truth.
Colonel Jessup, did you order the Code Red?
You don't have to answer that question.
I'll answer the question. You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
Partly because it's an incredible scene, and I recently revisited that film and it had me completely in its spell that moment again. Jack Nicholson is just wonderful in it. But also because I recently, for Total Film a couple of issues ago, interviewed Kiefer Sutherland, and he told me a great story about it, which he said, you know, it was one of those scenes that rarely happens in film where everyone comes in to watch it because they know it's Nicholson's big moment. That even the people not shooting that day, all the actors came in and were sort of watching in the galleys, including Kiefer. And Bruce Willis was there because obviously he was with Demi Moore, who stars in the film. And, you know, everyone was watching and they'd put aside 2 days to shoot this scene between Cruise and Nicholson, Rob Reiner directing. And basically Nicholson sat down, they rolled camera and he just nailed it. One take, just went boom. And Rob Reiner just turned around and said, right, everyone, you can have the next 2 days off. We're not going to get better than that. And everyone went home for 2 days. And it's just astonishing. It's absolutely astonishing.
Man, I wish Jane would do that when I absolutely nailed the feature, you know. Just, yeah. You nailed it. Go home for 2 days.
There you go.
Sadly, not enough time for that in the magazine world. Matt, what's your pick?
Okay, I don't know if this is like a cheat answer, but the first one that sprung to mind for me was 12 Angry Men, which I suppose is more of a sort of jury film than a courtroom film, if you want to put it that way. Mm-hmm. But it's just one of those films that I saw when I was quite young, just really stuck with me. Love the kind of authority and dignity of Henry Fonda, especially when you see it at a young age, that just whole idea about kind of like changing your mind, changing other people's minds. I just think it's such a great film. So that's my pick.
Yep. On a completely different tack, I'm going to go for Liar Liar, which was, I believe, my introduction to the courtroom drama, the courtroom scene. Just Jim Carrey at the top of his game. Absolutely hilarious. Surprisingly, like, rude as well. I watched it back and there's a lot of like swear words and a lot of talk about breasts in that scene as well, which I was very surprised about because I'm sure I saw that when I was about 8 or 9.
Yeah.
I must have been far too young to see that.
Are we talking about the sort of final showdown?
Oh, yeah.
There's obviously there's several scenes in there. Because I remember being weirdly moved by it in the end as well, because you kind of obviously regret that you suddenly see the father like wants to stay with his kids, you know, and I just, yeah.
Yeah, the joy of it is that he can't lie and all the kind of physical contortions that he puts himself into whenever he's trying to lie and he can't. Just hilarious, absolutely hilarious. Obviously not a patch on A Few Good Men and 12 Angry Men, but, you know, I enjoyed it.
It was a pivotal film for me.
Well, I don't know where to go from that note other than to bring this thing to a close. So with that, it's time to say goodbye, guys. Say goodbye, Jamie.
Goodbye.
Say goodbye, Matt.
Bye.
Bye, everybody. We'll be back next week where Jane will return. Hooray.
You all nicked me, old beauty. Right.
Breaking the law.